When people hear the words virtual reality, they often relate them to video games. But this sophisticated technology actually has the potential to change the way elite athletes prepare. Damien Farrow, a former AIS skill acquisition specialist, is using VR to improve AFL umpires' decision-making and says it could also help footballers perform better in high-pressure moments on the field. I'm Mark McGowan. This is Trends. Welcome to another week of Trends. We are privileged, our guest this week, from the AFL's umpiring department, coaching and innovation manager, Damien Farrow. Thanks for joining us, Damien.
Thanks, Mark. Good to be here.
Now, that doesn't do you justice because you have an enormous background that's fascinating and we're going to dive into that. But 17 years at the AIS, the Skill Acquisition Specialist was your title. And for the last nine of those years, you were obviously also at the Victoria University as the Professor of Skill Acquisition. Now, it's a fancy title, Skill Acquisition. Can you give us a bit of an insight for those who aren't aware of what that actually means?
Sure. So, yeah, it's a bit of a trend in my career. I come up with long, fancy titles. That's always, you know, a good starting point. But, yeah, so skill acquisition, for those that aren't familiar, it's really how do we assist athletes in particular, and now in my case umpires, to fast track their skill development. And that can be a young athlete coming through a talent pathway, or it can be an elite performer who's obviously very good at many things but might need to add another element to their game or learn a new skill. So essentially people are probably going, well, isn't that what a coach does? And absolutely it is. And I suppose what the skill acquisition specialist does is provides the empirical or the scientific evidence about how we learn skills most effectively. And we try and work with coaches to mesh what coaches know from doing it on a daily basis in practice. So the art of coaching, we bring in the science of coaching, if you like.
Now, obviously, as we know, the AIS, it's the home of sport in Australia. There's all sorts of sports, obviously Olympic sports from all the way down, but which sports have you worked in? Is there any you've worked in more prominently than others? And can you give us an example of where skill acquisition has actually helped an athlete and where you've taken them to another level?
Yeah. So the great thing about the AIS is, as you said, it's a real hotbed for sport. Mm. And so 35 sports programs. And over my career, I probably work with most of them in some way, shape or form. And as you said, some more than others. My most recent experiences were in the sport of swimming. So I came from a background of what we would call working in interceptive or team-based sports, so where there's lots of decision-making and so forth, and then transitioned over into swimming where there's not a lot of interception or the like. And the principles are the same. Okay. So you apply the same principles across both sports. There's obviously nuances that we'll go into. How we help is, for instance, if I think to our most recent Olympic campaign, Mac Horton wanting to shed some time off his turns. And so working, as we always do, in that environment in a team context, so you've got biomechanical support, measurement of the movement, you've got psychology, you've got physiology, you've got skill acquisition, you've got the coach. So there's a real team effort. But in terms of refining Mac's turns, it really comes down to a subtle movement variation where we're trying to provide feedback technology so that he's able to, if you can visualise how many turns Mac would do through a training year, yep. How do we increase the richness of that training so that he's more aware when he's contacting the wall at the right amount of time to maximise his propulsion off the wall? So we're able to introduce feedback technology there to really shape his turn performance over a lead-in period into the Olympics, and he's then able to transfer that skill into performance. That's where the psychology comes in. And then, obviously, he had a really good result in Rio. And so,
obviously, you take a bit of credit for that, Damien.
No, I wouldn't at all. He's the one doing all the work. But how skill acquisition fits, it's around that feedback methodology that we provide that otherwise might go untapped in a normal coaching environment.
What I'd love to, talking about skill acquisition, kicking the ball is such a massive discussion point in the AFL. Obviously, football is the name of the sport in general, but What are your thoughts on the way even junior footballers are being taught to kick the footy? What skills set we're seeing when they get to the AFL level?
Yeah, so in my career, so if I've had a 25-year career in Skillac, I'm experiencing my toughest coaching challenge right now, which is I coach my under 14 girls side at Bowie Morris Sharks Football Club, and so my daughters are in those teams, and coaching the girls how to kick. It's really, I'm having to use all my skills there. So, and that's where it starts, junior football. And we see boys, so the traditional stereotype, boys will kick in the backyard and then the girls are entering the sport a little bit later. Mm. And what we see is it's a real shaping of all these developmental experiences that you have. How much unstructured play or time you spend with a football, it's massive. And I think if you talk to all our coaches at the senior level, there's this argument, which I think holds some weight, that kids of today aren't engaging in as much unstructured play as what maybe a generation before them did. And then as we shape that into kicking, well, then their feel for how to intercept a ball is slightly different. And so we know that we need to shape behaviour, and therefore we need really good coaching from a reasonably young age. We need kids that explore, and then we need to be able to shape that kicking. And I don't know if that's happening as effectively as it could be. And so I know that within the AFL, the coaching department are really looking into new methods and curriculum to enhance that.
David Rath, obviously one of your colleagues, playing a big role in that.
Exactly. So he's got great experience, and that will positively change. So I think it starts there, definitely, as you flag, with the experiences kids have as when they're young. And then as you get through the talent pathway to the 18s and then into senior football, you've already got a history of a movement pattern that then is either technically efficient or maybe it's not so efficient. And then coaches are again having to make decisions about, can I positively impact this player's technical prowess or their skill, as we like to call it. And sometimes you can, and other times it might be that it's too ingrained as a habit. And so you've got to make really educated decisions about that. And I think that's where there's a real challenge as well. So there's a whole range of things. The data that we're getting on players now, their physical capabilities to make change, they all impact the decisions a coach will make around whether they can positively impact skill. But what we're seeing is that everyone's suggesting that it's not at a high level compared to maybe previous occasions. Yet the coaches...
Is that perception fair? Yeah, or is it one of those things where it's just the eye test isn't accurate?
Yeah, and that's what their coaches would defend the players and say, oh, they're way more skillful than I was when I played 10, 20 years ago. So you hear Chris Scott as a good example there, always defending his players' skill level. And I think he's right. I think they are more skilled, and then you've got to start looking at the game, and the demands of the game are very different. And so the time stress, the fatigue, the conditions, the pressure, they're all different to probably what was previously experienced. I still think there's an argument that we can make our players more adaptable than they are, and then that you start looking at training programs, you look at the time they spend on kicking skill, and the way they spend their time on kicking skill, and I think there's some low-hanging fruit there within the clubs, and that's where, again, wearing my bias hat, if you like, that's where I think the science of skill acquisition can support some of the coaching that happens out there at the moment.
Just going back to the initial question around junior footballers and the way they kick the ball, you talked about that backyard, you know, the process beginning there and lots of kicking, and you mentioned as well the time they're spending all the way through on their kicking. But breaking it right down, how should a junior footballer learn how to kick a football?
Yeah, I think the coaching curriculum is going to solve this soon or make some comments on this soon. But for mine, it's really give them a ball, and it doesn't even need to be a footy to start with. It could be anything. And let the child just kick the ball or work out how to kick it. And all they've got to do is watch a clip of current football, and kids are very good at imitating. So they don't need any instruction. They just need to look at a couple of clips, let them put a ball in their hand and learn how to kick, and just let them explore that for a period of time. And no doubt there's some non-negotiables about how you control the ball from hand to foot, And that's where a good coach might cue a child on just hold the ball a little bit longer or push it out a bit further, whatever it might
be. Better ball drop.
Yeah, whatever it is. So, sure, there's some coaching there, but we've really got to let the kids explore how it works for them for a period of time.
Okay.
And I think that's
just time.
And it is. It's repetitions in the backyard, and it's not, you know, deliberate repetition, but it's just fun. And, you know, one of the philosophies or – it's not a philosophy, but it's a I'd love to run an experiment on this. I think some of our best kicks and more – they're evasive. So they're able to buy themselves time. So we see left-footers get the benefit of turning onto their left foot unless it's really well known. They always get a little bit extra time and therefore they execute their kick reasonably well. I think kids that grow up with a dog in the backyard where you've got to balk the dog, then take a kick, I reckon that transfers through. So that's the sorts of – environmental conditions that it's not deliberate, it's not manufactured, but I reckon it has a positive impact on what we see later on in their development.
Who would have thought the dog, getting a family dog is the key to that journey to the AFL?
No one smothers better than the family dog. So if you can evade them, get the ball onto boot, you're doing really well.
There's going to be a spike in pet stores this weekend. But you touched on also the possibility of improving a technique, improving a kicking style at once they get to the AFL level. What are the difficulties there? Because you've talked about ingrained techniques, attitudes, just so much repetition over so much time. How can you instantly change something? How do the experts, once they're at that level, they're already elite in so many other areas, but they might have a deficiency in that area. How do you go about improving it? And then secondly, as I said at the start, what are the difficulties?
Yeah, well, time's the difficulty. So the time that you can spend on it and hence the number of repetitions you can put in. So that's a limitation. So you've got to assess whether you have sufficient time in your program to devote to it. And then the other key factor is the athlete willing to change? So unless the athlete really wants to make this change, sees the benefit of making the change, and the coaching panel equally think it's going to be a positive shift, it's like wanting to quit smoking. You've really got to want to do it to start with. So if you've got that in place, then it becomes a matter of optimizing the amount of repetition you have available. And I think that's one of the areas where we could do better. If I make a general observation, it's we're quite conservative with skill development. So we're not as aggressive as we could be in how challenging we make the training conditions. And what we'll find is that athletes can adapt if you challenge their system more than we currently do. And you can almost get more progressive learning by just being a little bit more aggressive, being a little bit more flexible in the conditions that you set up for coaching. So often it becomes very, you know, you break the skill down so far that you have to then reconstruct it. So how can we cue an athlete into whatever it is they've got to improve by keeping the skill more holistic, representing it within the context in which they've got to use that skill, and you can save some time. And a good example is just if you think about the kicking that you do where you kick to each other and it's just back and forth kicking, you might knock up 30 or 40 kicks, but have you put any effort into those 30 or 40 kicks? So each one of those opportunities is lost. So those 30 or 40 kicks, if they're really cued and thought about, you're going to get massive gain, but it just doesn't happen. And so to me, it's just that real attention to detail is what's missing. And we have it in other areas of performance. So you don't get in the gym and see lack of attention to detail when they're in the gym building muscle. It's exactly the same with a skill. You just got to have that same quality and you'll get massive gains from doing that.
Now, we might flow on to this topic again with what I'm about to talk about, but with virtual reality. You talk about getting them in the right, challenge them in different ways and putting them in game scenarios, situations that can potentially help them when it actually happens. But before we get to that, obviously you've been employed in the umpiring department. You've only been here since February. Look, it's a generic question, but it's been a hot topic this year, the umpiring and the standard of umpiring and mistakes as well have been a big talking point. And there's been a perception that the umpiring hasn't been as good this year. What's your take on it? Coming in almost as a fresh voice, a fresh set of eyes. How do you think the umpires are going this year?
Yeah, so yeah, I've found it fascinating, and you know, I didn't know if it was a normal year or it's like this every year, but it has been fascinating coming in. And the first thing I did is I looked at the data, and you know, if you look at an average round of football, typically umpires get about 82-83% correct decisions. And
is that a good number?
Well, when you look at it, it's not a very bad number, that's for sure. So you look at it from previous seasons, and it's largely the same. So it's hard for me to go, oh, well, I don't know if we're better or worse than previous years. That's people's comments that have watched a lot of football. But when I look at the data, well, they're reasonably similar. Then you look at the whole concept of decision making accuracy. And I think we should have high expectations, but we should also understand. So a team of three umpires will make around 1,000 decisions or adjudications in a game of football.
That's astonishing.
Yeah, it is. Out of those 1,000, the whistle might be heard on 300 occasions. So that might just be – it might be a call of play on, and on occasions it will be a free kick, and around, 40 times a match, I think our average number of free kicks. So if we start thinking about it like that, to be in the high mid-80s, they're doing a lot of things really, really well, really well. And I think so we can focus on the one they get wrong, and they will. They're human. They'll make errors. And I think part of what I saw early in the year was a real focus on the error rather than, geez, for most of the game – They you know, everything's 100% there. You know,
it's not how the fans work, is it? It's
no,
not how social media.
And I get that. And at the outside looking in, the other thing that I was staggered by was my lack of understanding of the rules of the game. So I pride myself on being a reasonably well-read, intelligent guy. I was miles off. So if that's me, someone that reads a lot and goes into that detail, it just makes me wonder what our fans and who are already going to have a bias, which they should. You know, they're there to support. But, yeah, I don't think we understand the rules. And some of the rules are possibly too grey or complex, and maybe we need to try and clean them up over time. But so I think on the whole they do a fantastic job. And while we can improve it, no doubt about it, and particular areas we can lift, I think, the what I experienced early on I thought was just quite a negative position.
With all that in mind, obviously you've been brought in to do a particular role. Can you explain in as brief and as simplistic way as possible what your brief is?
So it probably circles back to where we started a little bit. So we've got a fantastic team of expert coaches coaching the skill of umpiring really well. What they probably didn't have was support around, well, what a contemporary concepts in science of skill learning that can be applied to umpiring. So part of my role is to literally support the coaches to provide them some of those concepts and ideas and demonstrate how we might be able to adapt it to coaching umpiring skill.
So you generally work with the coaches rather than the umpires directly?
Yeah, I work through the coaches. It's not to say I don't work with umpires, but yeah, my role is to support the coaches in that respect. They're the ones at the coalface. And then equally, so that's the coaching part of the job. And then the innovation part is just to say, hey, let's not rest on our laurels. Let's continue to, like a club does, let's get ahead of the curve. How can we make decision-making of umpires more effective? How can we make their communication more effective? How can we just, and equally, how can we make the role of umpiring more attractive to the whole pathway so that we can really flood it with quality umpiring right through from community to high performance. So it becomes very broad very quickly in terms of what I'm trying to do, and there's a lot of strategies there that we could probably pick off that I can discuss.
And you're obviously trying to improve ultimately the decision making, because as we touched on not long ago, they're making 1,000 decisions, so it's a key part of their role.
It's the primary role, right? I mean, I think the management of the game is the other primary role. So we've got umpires that do that incredibly well, the way they set the tone and the way they communicate with the players, et cetera. So that management piece, not to be underestimated. But ultimately, the thing I hear most is, we want consistency of decision-making. And I get that. So that's consistency within a team of three on the field, and it's consistency from game to game. So that's what we need to work on.
Now, we all saw that great vision from the GoPro. It was released on social media, seeing an umpire in at the centre bounce, running around, you're hearing the breathing, you're hearing the, how quick the game's moving, how quickly they have to make decisions, run to different positions. My understanding is that was a big part of your thinking to get that involved, but it has been something we've seen sort of 5-6 years ago, we talked about. Yeah. How is it being used differently now to try to actually make a positive impact on the decision-making?
So, yeah, right through my career, I suppose one of the things we've had to do, if you're going to try and improve the decision-making of an athlete or an umpire, we need to get vision from their perspective. So we need to find ways to increase the volume of decisions they have to make. And equally, you talk to players, umpires, they'll go, oh, the broadcast, well, that's not what we see. So we have to find ways to get what they see. GoPro at this stage is our best opportunity, where that we've got a chest-mounted camera, which we find just a lot more stable than putting it on the head, and we get, in some instances, we get a really accurate representation of what they see. Other times, it's not quite right because maybe they've turned their head and we know that they can move to see things from different angles, yep. Whereas the GoPro on the chest limits that. But those instances where we do get a good look, ruck contests, marking contests, what we can then do is put them into headsets or large screen projections, and we can show umpires, well, this is what you're seeing, what decision would you make? And so really it's all about building a library of situations so that we can then proactively develop the decision-making skills. And different umpires, like players, will go through peaks and troughs in their interpretation of a particular decision. So if we've got hundreds of examples from their perspective, we can systematically train those umpires to calibrate their decision-making if required. And so that's how we're using it. I think in the past, it's an intuitively logical idea to capture it, but we just haven't had that follow through into training design and programming of how we can systematically use it for individual umpires on a needs basis. So that's where we're heading with that.
So is every umpire every weekend wearing this technology in every game, or are you picking the best umpires or the least experienced? How are you going about that?
Yeah, nothing that elaborate just yet. So we've got one camera that we use each week on one umpire in one game, and then Channel 7 have started doing a game a week as well. So we're essentially getting two games a week from two umpires' perspectives, and then we're just compiling a database or a library, if you like. Going forward, I would love to see that if we find that it is really successful, and I think it will be, we might increase the reach in terms of more cameras, gives us more vision, gives us more situations, and it'll just build that library.
And it's obviously moving towards that virtual reality space. We're all fascinated about it. We don't know a lot about it from the outside unless you're working right in it. What can virtual reality do for umpiring to start with? Because that's obviously the topic we're discussing here. But how also can it impact a player's training during the week as well, if you're able to answer that?
Yeah, so again, virtual reality, the concept's been around for a long time, and we've played with it for, I think back to my AIS days, back in 2003, we were playing around with 3D vision. And the logic is simple. It's going to be the best representation of the game other than being in the game. And the advantage is you can selectively manipulate the game. So you can have more of something that you want to train more of, and you can amp up quality. So crowd noise, the incongruence between crowd noise and a decision. There's a whole host of things that we can do in a virtual environment that you can't do necessarily in the real world. Or you get it in the real world, but it's a long... So if we want a fast-track skill, it does provide a tool for that. The caveat, of course, is, well, is it transferring to performance, or is it one step removed? And in previous time, we would argue that, yeah, it's one step removed. What we're seeing more and more as technology's got better and better, the quality of the fidelity, the representativeness of the virtual environment is closer than ever before to the real world. And the emotional and physical responses that we're getting sort of tell us that, oh, yeah, there's quite a good match here. So okay. The closer that match is, the better off we'll be. And I think there's some instances where it's clearly the match isn't strong enough, but there's other instances where there's a really nice fit. So we've got to play in the space where we can see that we're going to get positive transfer and let the technology continue to evolve in those other areas. So you think about the game or the players rather than umpires. I think in umpiring we can do a lot because we don't have any physical actions to make. It's the physical actions in the virtual environment that are really challenging. Having haptic information or that feel of vibration of the ball hitting the foot, or they're really hard to build in over and above just the actual vision and the environment that you're immersed in. So that'll take longer than potentially what we can do in umpiring, where it's literally give us an environment that's really representative and then the umpire's making a verbal response, which is really easy to do in that world.
How easy is it though to, I think of pressure as being something that's pretty hard to replicate. You can obviously put noise into it. You can say it's a tight game. You can tell them what the situation is, but it probably doesn't from the outside. I'll look at it and I go, I don't understand how you could actually replicate, say, for example, at the weekend, the North Melbourne and Essendon game where Sean Attlee from the Kangaroos has turned the ball over in the corridor and it ends up being the match-winning moment. Essendon wins the game. Sean Attlee gets discussed on all the footy shows for making the wrong decision. But how can, say, Sean, for example, be put in a virtual reality situation and that pressure actually replicated in that scenario where potentially the next time he gets in that situation, he makes a different call?
Yeah, it's a good observation. I think the analogy I use is that you got to build the cake in the real world and the virtual reality is the icing on the cake. So I don't think it's ever going to replace what you experience in real life environments anytime soon anyway. But just last week, we took our umpiring department to a virtual reality centre and we had to shoot zombies in a construction site. You look at it from the outside looking in and you're just seeing these guys wearing headsets and a backpack and they're carrying this gun and they're shooting in thin air and you go, oh, really? You put that headset on and the heart rate, the emotional responses, the voices, the calling, the quick, get over here, I'm going to get shot by, the zombies come. You just got this amazing response, and that's what it can do. It is so immersive that you do elicit emotional responses more than you can get, I think, from just watching film or whatever it might be. So there's something in that, what we would call the affective domain, so the emotional aspect of performance, that if we are unlocking a little bit of that in the virtual world, and that to me is what we're getting transfer on. So I think while we won't represent exactly that pressure, we can shift it quite a bit. It's quite incredible. And so you've got to do it almost to know what I'm talking about. But once you get in there, you'll go, oh, okay, yeah, I see what he means.
Just finally, Damien, we've touched a little bit on your background before you came to the AFL, but we also didn't touch on the fact that you've worked in a consultancy basis at three different clubs, Adelaide, West Coast and the Western Bulldogs, obviously as part of that Victoria University relationship. But my understanding is you spent quite a bit of time at the Crows and we've already touched on how virtual reality can potentially help players in different scenarios. But that was sort of part of your work a little bit, not so much the VR, but just helping players make the right decisions. And I think it was driving the ball inside 50 and making those sorts of decisions. Can you talk us through what sort of work you did with the Crows?
Yeah, so the great thing about the Crows was the head coach, Neil Craig, at the time, is a great example of a coach that understands the art of coaching and wants to support it with the science of coaching. And so I suppose I was that guy. The decision-making work we did, we had a large projection of forward 50 scenarios shot from the perspective of the forward entry kicker. So somewhere around that 60, 70 metres out from goal, now needing to kick the ball, that's where we had the camera and we would capture situations and there'd be all sorts of, there'd be an extra defender in there, it'd be two on two, there'd be a lead up, there'd be a tall bloke dropping back to the square. So lots of different patterns that midfielders are confronted with routinely. And the logic was really simple, that if you look at training, for a midfielder to see that situation in training in match sim, if they're lucky, they might get three or four repetitions per training session. So how can we give them an extra 20 or 30 without the physical cost of doing the physical training. And that's what the large screen projection provided us. So we're able to put players in there. We created all sorts of games where they might compete against another midfielder who's first to hit the right option as it presents itself on the screen. So they would literally kick footballs into a screen in the training centre there at Adelaide.
Okay, and so it was basically the virtual reality then.
Sort of, in a way. It was a video projection kicking into a wall. So somewhat a virtual environment, if you use the term loosely. So, and the logic was really simple. Let's maximise repetition of a key skill that we're not able to get enough of in our physical training time that we have available.
Was that ahead of their time? Like with the Crows, obviously, you're not going to be too, you're going to be modest about your own work, but was that ahead of what other AFL clubs were doing at that stage? And are we seeing that everywhere now? Would every club be doing that sort of stuff?
My understanding was at the time we were the ones doing it. And then, you know, like everything in footy, it started to get mirrored in various ways. And you mentioned David Rath earlier. I know Dave set up a similar system when he went to Hawthorn.
With the Hawks,
West Coast were playing around with a system like that. And then I'm sure it spread without knowing in great detail. So I think the thing that I found unique about it was the coaching or the team's support of sticking with something like that. So it's not a one-off that's going to have any benefit, but it was a consistent training program element that we had in place for a period of time. And that's what you need to get improvement.
Condition the players.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll leave it there, Damon. It's been a fascinating chat. I reckon I've probably got another hour of questions for you, but we'll leave it there for the moment. You're a busy man, and thanks so much for your insight. And we'd love to, again, have you on in the future if we can manage to convince the media managers upstairs.
Thanks, Mark. I've really enjoyed it. You've got a great little show from the different episodes I've heard, so I've just dragged it down a little bit, but never mind.
Good on you, Damon. Thank you.